I wish there was a simple answer as to why it developed with no cars, but, you know, it didn't make any sense. It was difficult to get cars over here.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
I'm Bill Freeman, and I'm a writer. I live on Toronto Island, which is a pretty super place just within the city of Toronto, the biggest city in Canada. What do I write? I write books for young people, for kids. I write a fair bit of... I'm interested in cities and how cities work and how communities work, so I've written a lot about that, actually. And I'm doing a lot of work in film, particularly just following my interests. Right at the moment, I'm working on a big project on the Canadian co-op movement. Cooperatives, cooperative stores, cooperative housing, cooperative workplaces, you know? There's a lot of co-ops. It's like it's one of the big untold stories, actually, in Canada. I've got a play that I'm doing. I'm doing a lot of stuff.
What's the play?
A play is called Glory Days, and it's set, it's a historical play, set in 1946 during the Stelco strike of that year, one of Canada's most famous strikes that really helped establish the Canadian trade union movement, actually. So it's a what the director calls a play with music. There's a lot of union songs in it, but basically it tells the story of eight people and their experiences during the strike. I grew up in London, Ontario. I had an uncle in Hamilton who taught at the university there, and that drew me to Hamilton. But, you know, I got a job when I was a young guy and went off to live in Hamilton. I was there for about 10 years. Went to McMaster myself, actually, while I was there.
Now, your book, Their Town,
yeah.
The Media, the Mafia, and the Party Machine, a great book, by the way.
Yeah.
One of my first history lessons in Hamilton. So were you involved in the movements that were going on that you were writing about?
I was involved in a number of the movements, the community movements. In fact, it's always been a thing I find myself drawn into is community movements of one sort or another. I'm involved right now in one of Toronto's big community struggles, which is the struggle against the airport in downtown Toronto. Many of us are trying to close the airport. So it's been a thing that I've done really all of my adult life. When I was in Hamilton, I was involved in community organizations. We're involved in a welfare rights organization and in an organization called the Victoria Park Community Organization, and they were real grassroots organizations. They were very interesting for me. I learned lots. Well, communities, the way most of us define them, is usually in geographic terms. But, you know, you can talk about communities like, oh, communities of interest, you know, stamp collectors, I guess, are communities. People in Canada often define themselves by their racial or ethnic origins, you know, the Jewish community or Italian or black community. But the way most of the type of organizing that I've been interested in, just myself personally, has been around trying to make livable, sustainable communities. That's been very important for me. I think for a lot of people, frankly. I live in Toronto Island, and I came to live here because I wanted to live in this type of community. There's no cars here. It's a community of very ordinary people. The houses aren't very big. They're quite modest. A number of artists live here. But it's a community that if you will, has been a sustainable community for a long time. Environmental issues are very important here. So I sought out this community in a way, or it sought me out, I'm not sure which, but I came to live here because of all of those things. Well, the role of children, I have four children myself. That has always been important for me. I've got grandchildren now. And communities really work through children in many ways. If you have a community that's safe, where the parents feel that their children are safe, those are always communities that really work, I think. They work really at many different levels. But essentially, they're communities where people talk to each other, they have an affinity with them, they interact with their neighbors, socialize with their neighbors. You know, there's the saying that it takes the whole community to raise a child, and I think that's true. And I think one of the problems in North American communities is we've tended to forget that, you know, that's been especially with our modern lifestyles. People drive cars everywhere. Cars are a great barrier, it seems to me, in communities. You know, you have a vehicle of a couple of thousand pounds hurtling down a street. I mean, any parent's going to be concerned about that and about the safety of their children. But cars connect people. You know, they're a way of connecting people, but they're also, roads are great barriers to people. And in this community, in this car-free community, those barriers you see just break down. You know, your neighbor across the street is as close as the person that lives next to you. There's not that barrier. I think that those are very important things for people raising families. You know, there are other real difficulties. You know, I grew up in an age where, you know, parents only, you know, my mother stayed at home and looked after children. The families that I had, you know, my own family, I mean, we couldn't do that. We couldn't afford that. And most families, that's true. Both parents work. And that has had a huge impact on communities as well. And so we've got to try, it seems to me, and rethink communities. Think about sustainable communities. One of the most important elements is thinking about communities in relation to children. One of the reasons why this airport that we're fighting against, why we've done that, is because we think that if this airport becomes a big, massive airport, it's going to destroy the whole quality of life here. And for what? For why? You know, so a few people can fly off to, you know, Cleveland and get there, you know, 20 minutes earlier. Excuse me, if that's going to destroy or harm the quality of life, the ability to be able to raise your children in a sustainable way, then, excuse me, you know, that is not worth it. The issues in community and community organizing that I was involved in Hamilton many years ago were focused around similar sorts of issues. A lot of it was around poverty. Not that Hamilton had any more poverty than any place else. In fact, Hamilton's quite a wealthy city. But how do we help people who are living in poverty not only escape their poverty, but to live real and potentially effective lives? And one of the things I've come to believe and understand is the notion of what's generally called sort of the empowerment of people. That people need to be empowered, and they need to have control over their own lives and over their own communities. People get discouraged, especially people who live in poverty. Nothing, you know, incidentally, I didn't grow up in poverty myself. I grew up in a very middle-class home. My dad was a high school teacher. But I, as a young man, came to understand that, you know, poverty was, you know, had so many different elements of it and made it so difficult for people to sort of escape from that, the whole economic reality of their lives. So, you know, escaping from poverty is not only going out and getting a job. In fact, that may just lead to a different form of poverty. What's really key is to try and help people to have power over their own lives and to be able to make decisions for themselves and for their children and for the people around them. You know, one of the ways often power in our society is defined as political power. And incidentally, I think that's very, very important. But there is a type of personal power that's even more important and more fundamental. People who are so discouraged by the problems that they face in their lives are not going to even think about political power in any traditional sense. So that these have been issues that I've sort of struggled with and tried to and think about. It's reflected in my writing as well.
I'm Noam Chomsky. You're listening to Radio Free School on CFMU 93.3.
Now, back to the island, because you've also written a book about the island. What does the island look like, or what's
Well, the island is a place just off Toronto. Toronto's on Lake Ontario, so about a couple of kilometers from the very downtown of Toronto are the islands. And in fact, the islands form the harbor, and Toronto was here because of its harbor. So when the islands were developed, first of all, there was no housing here. There were some fishermen that lived out here, and there were a couple of hotels came out here. We're talking about the early part of the 19th century. And gradually, parts of the island were developed as a cottage community, as a community for people to come in the summer. In fact, in the winter, it was always a problem because the Toronto Bay would freeze over, and it freezes over even to this very day, let me tell you. And so it became impossible for people to really live here year-round. So gradually, by 1930 or so, they began solving this issue about living here year-round because they had boats that could slice through the ice without too much trouble. And a permanent community began to grow up here. I wish there was a simple answer as to why it developed with no cars, but, you know, it didn't make any sense. It was difficult to get cars over here. And it became a large part of the island became a park, and the city that managed the park didn't want any cars over here, and so it became a car-free community, which it remains to this very day. So there's 275 houses here. About 650 people live here. We have a school, an elementary school. We've got a Montessori school for preschoolers. We have two restaurants. One operates year-round. The other is just a summer operation. But there's no stores. Islanders have to live a very active life. People have bicycles. That's my means of transportation. I have a bicycle, and I use public transit when I go into the city. I don't own a car. And that's how we get along. There was, in fact, a controversy here on the island that went on for almost 30 years. There were a number of powerful politicians in the city who were in favor of demolishing the houses and just expanding the park. There's already an 800-acre park here on the island, and there's 44 acres here is in the community, and so they wanted to bulldoze the community and turn it into, enclose the land into the rest of the park. That was fought over, became one of the biggest political issues in the city of Toronto it went on for decades. In fact, it was ultimately resolved. Actually, the final deal, the final arrangement, the legislation keeps the land in the hands of the public. So the city, in fact, owns the land, and the houses, the structures, are owned by people. So my partner and I own this structure. That's ours. The lease on the land is for 99 years. It was a good compromise. I was involved in the final negotiations of the deal. I can remember at meetings people say, "Well, do you think about what's going to happen after 99 years?" And we'd say, "No, we're not going to solve all the problems." So it's, in fact, my experience is a lot of difficult political issues are solved in this way, you know, through compromise and innovation. You know, I've been through a few of these types of intense political negotiations in my career, and it's amazing what can be crafted if the will is there to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. How does someone come to live on the island?
Originally, back in the days when the controversy was going on, you had to be sort of a person to take some risks to come and live here. That's when I came, actually, and I can remember facing the idea, well, you might lose your home, you might, you know, this is a very intense political battle. And so there were a number of people that came here. A lot of the people that came during that period were artists. You know, I'm a writer myself, and I'm sort of in that category. A number of visual artists, actually, and the island's known for a number of quite remarkable visual artists, but there were actors and playwrights that lived here, and musicians. After the settlement, one of the consequences is that it's much more difficult to get onto the island, and so there's a waiting list. The final decision, one of the keys was trying to keep the community affordable. And as part of the legislation that governs the island is that you can't sell your house for market. You can sell your house essentially for the replacement value of the structure. So there's no sort of speculative thing here. So in my house, people talk about this as the $1 million view. Well, I can't get $1 million out of it because I'm not allowed to earn that. Frankly, that's great for me. I want this to remain an affordable community. Mm-hmm. Again, one of the